Welcome to Cafe of Delight, conversations that enlighten and inspire with me, your host, Gail West. We are at the precipice of one of the most exciting evolutions in human history. From science to spirituality, culture, arts, cutting-edge psychotherapies, new economies, and more. We will explore how to create a world where all can thrive. In a series of riveting interviews, you'll have the opportunity to hear from those that are actively working at the edges of local, regional, and global transformation. Join me, your host and author of the book Money Come Dance With Me, Gail West, to be inspired, delighted, and filled with hope for a new reality. Cafe of Delights starts now. Welcome to Cafe of Delights. I'm your host, Gail West. I'm so excited to have as my guest, Dr. Richard Schwartz. And Dick Schwartz began his career as a family therapist and an academic at the University of Chicago, University of Illinois at Chicago, where he discovered that family therapy alone did not achieve full symptom relief. And in asking patients why, he learned that they were plagued by what they called parts. These patients became his teachers as they described how their parts formed inner networks of relationship that resembled the families that he had been working with. He also found that as they focused on and thereby separated from their parts, they would shift into a state characterized by qualities like curiosity, calm, confidence, and compassion. He called that inner essence the self and was amazed to find it even in severely diagnosed and traumatized patients. From these explorations, the Internal Family Systems, IFS, model was born in the early 1980s. IFS is now evidence-based and has become a widely used form of psychotherapy, particularly with trauma. Provides a non-pathologizing, optimistic, and empowering perspective and a practical and effective set of techniques for working with individuals, couples, families, and more recently, corporations and classrooms. Dick lives with his wife, Jean, in Chicago, close to his three daughters and his growing number of grandchildren. Welcome, Dick. So happy to have you.
Great to see you, Gail. Yeah.
So the first question I ask everybody, since this is the Cafe of Delights, what is delighting you at this time?
Well, as you know, we moved from the Boston area to the back here to the Chicago area to be with my kids and grandkids. And I now have four grandkids as of about a week ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So that's delightful. And then as always, teaching or being with people as they explore their inner worlds is still a big source of delight for me as well.
And what brings you hope at this time?
You know, what brings me hope, because our planet needs a lot of hope right now.
Yes, indeed.
I guess what I would say is my vision is to keep trying to bring more what we call self to the planet. And I have a history of working with, as you do, clients who, when you start with them, their inner systems seem totally hopeless and they're dominated by really extreme protectors. But as we access a little bit of self, everything can change very quickly. So that's my hope, is that if we can access a critical mass of self in this, not just this culture, but on this planet, that things can change pretty quickly for the better.
That's so exciting. I'm going to take a little break. So I've known you for years, but I'd like for you to go into, for our audience, what is the origin story of IFS?
Yeah, I think you were around for part of that. I don't know.
Long time ago, met you in 1990, I think. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I graduated from a doctoral program in family therapy back in 1980. And I was one of those obnoxious family therapists who thought we'd found the Holy Grail and decided to prove that by doing an outcome study with bulimia. And found to my frustration that we could reorganize the families just right. And still a number of my clients continued to binge and purge. And so out of frustration, I began asking why. And they started talking what to me at the time was the strange language of parts. And they'd say some version of, when something bad happens in my life, it triggers this critic who's calling me all kinds of nasty names. And then that brings up a part who feels totally empty and alone and worthless and young. And that feeling is so sort of distressing that in comes the binge to take me away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel better for a minute, but then the critic comes back after the binge and attacks me for the binge too. And so then that empty, young, worthless part gets triggered again and the binge has to come back. And as I heard all that, it sounded familiar in a way to the kind of sequences I was studying in external families. And also it was scary because I thought, maybe these kids are sicker than I thought. They're talking about these parts as if they've got a lot of autonomy and they fight with each other. And I held that position until I actually listened inside my own head. And oh my God, I've got them too. And some of mine are as extreme as theirs. And so then I just got very curious and, long story short, learned fairly quickly that they aren't what they seem, as I had clients interview them inside and stopped, you know, at some point stopped having clients fight with them or mm-hmm. try to ignore them and actually listen to them. They would all tell a story of how they were forced into these roles they didn't like and how much they were trying to protect the client, even the parts, the critics, or the, in this case, the binge parts, even the parts that seem destructive, really had a good intention if you were to listen to them. And that blew my mind because I, like most of psychotherapy at the time, made the assumption that the critic is some kind of internalized parental voice, negative voice, and the binge is an out of control impulse. And I was trying to get my client initially to fight with the critic and control the binge and was making it worse. So when I finally got away from that and just had clients listen, all of these parts would tell basically a similar story across client of how they were forced into their roles back when the client was a child
mm-hmm.
to protect them. And so that kind of that opened the door. This is like the 40th anniversary this year of the model starting, really. And so that moment back in 1983, when I really got hip to the fact they aren't what they seem and they're trying their best. So that from that time on, rather than getting clients to try to control them, I try to get clients to listen to them. And when they do listen to them, they will learn about how they're trying to protect. And they're often trying to protect other parts that are very vulnerable and that they've tried to lock away for their own protection. And so the basic assumption now, 40 years later, is that they aren't, these parts aren't what they seem. And they're not the product of trauma, because that is an assumption I've been fighting now my whole career,
mm-hmm.
that it was the unitary mind that got split apart by the trauma, and they're just shards of the broken vase. So my position is they're all valuable. We're born with them. They're all here to help us in our lives. And they get forced out of their naturally valuable states by traumas, by attachment injuries, by also dynamics in our family where some parts aren't welcome in our family. Like if you think about if you got angry in your family, how your parents reacted, or if you felt really sad and hurt, how they reacted. So some parts, other systems might call these young inner children who, before they're hurt, are playful and loving and open and creative, and we love them. They help us in our lives with those qualities. But after they get hurt, they're the most sensitive part. So they take on what we call the burdens of worthlessness or terror or emotional pain from the trauma, from the attachment injury. And once they get those burdens, we don't want to be around them because they can make us feel so bad. Mm-hmm. So we tend to lock them away in inner basements. So as I was, because I'm a systems thinker and family therapist, as I was interviewing clients about these parts, I tried to map that inner territory in the same way we would map families' dynamics. And that was one distinction that leaped out immediately between these parts I just described, who get hurt the most, and then the parts that are forced out of their naturally valuable states to become the protectors of those parts. So pretty early on, that map became obvious and has held up as a really good way to understand internal systems ever since. So that was parts. And then, again, because I was a family therapist, I was trying to get these parts to talk to each other, especially after I got hip to the fact they're not what they seem and they deserve to be listened to. I was trying to get my client to listen to them rather than fight with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I would find that maybe I'm having you talk to your critic and it's going okay, but suddenly you're furious at the critic. And it reminded me of family sessions where I'm having two family members talk to each other, and suddenly one is furious with the other. And we were taught to look around and see if somebody isn't siding with one against the other subtly. And you'd often find that was true. And so you'd get that person to move in the room out of the line of vision of the person they were siding with. And things would settle down and you'd have a better dialogue. And I thought, maybe the same thing's happening with this inner system. As I was having you try to talk to your critic, some part that hates the critic has jumped in. So I would say some version of, Gail, can you find the one who hates the critic? And could you get it to just relax back in there a little bit? And most people would say, okay, it did. And I'd say, now how do you feel toward the critic? And it would be an entirely different answer. Seconds earlier, you hated it or you were afraid of it. Mm-hmm. We get those parts to open space. And it seemed to release this other person who now is calm, confident, and curious. And just say, I'm just curious about why it calls me names.
Mm-hmm.
Or even compassionate. I feel sorry for it. And when you were in that state, and I had you talk to the critic would react very well and would be freed up to talk about how it got its job, and we could get it out of where it was stuck in the past and maybe heal what it protected, and everything would transform, often very quickly. And I would try that same process of getting other parts to open space inside. And lo and behold, the same person would pop out, seemed like, with those same C-word qualities of calm, curiosity, confidence, compassion. Also, courage, creativity, clarity, and connectedness. And when I would ask clients, what part of you is that? They'd say some version of, that's not a part like these others. That's me. That's myself. So I came to call that the self with a capital S.
Mm-hmm.
And now 40 years later and thousands of people using this all over the world, we can safely say that that self is in everybody, can't be damaged, knows how to heal, and is just beneath the surface of these parts such that when it comes out, it can kind of take over the healing. And that's the big deal about IFS. That sort of changes everything. So that's a very condensed version of the origin story.
It's really fascinating when you think about the idea that we have a self which is whole and complete. And it's everybody has that self. And it can't, it's what you're saying is a game changer, is a huge game changer, as opposed to looking at people as damaged.
That's right. Yeah.
And that in so many ways. And it's fascinating because when I think about it, where you were way back when I first met you, and I came across in my files the little one piece of paper that described all these little systems and where it is today. It's really, really evolved. It's worldwide, as opposed to, you know, in Chicago, most of the people in Chicago and the area only knew about it. And it's evolved in such an amazing way. And it's a testament to you as far as your courage to take this to the next level. Because you're right. A lot of people are going, hello, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have scars from the journey.
I'm sure you do.
In the early days, it was a really tough sell. You know, the multiple, what was called multiple personality disorder.
Yeah, MPD, right.
Had sort of the microphone on what these were and basically was saying that they're the product of trauma. They're pathologies. And that had permeated most of the thinking about them. That and the idea of internalizations. And so, yeah, most of the field was thinking they were what they seemed to be in their extreme state. And so it's only been, I guess, the last decade where it feels like IFS has a lot of purchase now and has had a lot of influence, but still not in the bastions of academia that I'd like to get into.
Well, supposedly that's the last place where change happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's they're typically 20, 30 years behind the times, not just, you know, with therapy, but other systems, because their textbooks are 20, 30 years behind the times.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating. When I think about it, it's cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that's cutting edge takes a while but somebody was telling me this, one of my clients was saying this morning that you guys are in Russia and Egypt and all these places where we think, oh, there's all this trauma, there's collective trauma, and hello, little by little, we're changing the planet in your own way. When we think about looking at each human being as whole and complete.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been very gratifying to see it spread around the world. And yeah, we have training programs all over the world now.
Yeah.
And you know, my guidance now is to try to bring it so that it's not just a psychotherapy, but to bring it to larger systems. And so part of this decade I've devoted to trying to bring it to corporate leaders, to social activists, to
mm-hmm.
We're trying to make it the map to the psychedelic territory. Just trying to expand the focus and the reach of it. And having some success.
So let's go back a little bit and just, you've talked about protectors, you've talked about burdens. Let's just kind of map a little bit more for the audience of just the system as you see it.
Sure. So I talked about these vulnerable parts that get hurt. And once they get hurt, we don't want to be around them because they have the power to overwhelm us with their pain or their terror or their sense of shame. And then it's hard to function. So we almost naturally try to lock them away in inner basements, and everybody around us tells us to do that. This is a rugged individualist culture that says, if you get traumatized, just move on. Don't look back. You can't
just buck up.
Buck up, let it go. And in doing that, you're actually letting go your most precious resources, these young parts that before they got hurt are so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And just by dint of being hurt, now you lock them away. And you don't have access to their wonderful qualities anymore. And then other parts are forced to become these protectors, leaving their valuable states. And so you become much more rigid, and when you get a lot of these exiles, you feel much more delicate. The world feels a lot more dangerous. So many things could trigger them. And so there are parts that are trying to manage your life so they don't get triggered. Because if they get triggered, it's like an explosion of flames of emotion that could overwhelm you. So some parts become these manager protectors whose job it is to keep people at a certain distance, maybe, or make you look perfect so no one rejects you, or get you to achieve a lot so you can counter the worthlessness, or take care of everybody so they depend on you and you you don't take care of yourself as a result, and so on. So these are some common manager roles.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't always work. And so an exile might get triggered, in which case other parts are standing by to get you away from that pain or that shame or terror. And we'll do it sometimes in quite extreme ways, because these, what we call firefighter protectors, don't care about the collateral damage to your body or your relationships. They just know they've got to get you away from that pain, or you're going to die. That's often what they think. So most of us have a kind of hierarchy of firefighter activities. The first one doesn't work, you go to the next one. If that doesn't work, the next one. And often suicide is at the top of the hierarchy. So that's the map. To flesh it out a little more, we have exiles protected by managers as the frontline protectors, and then these firefighters if necessary. And like I said, that's held up really well over these 40 years.
Thank you. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to go even more deeply into internal family systems with Dr. Richard Schwartz, Dick Schwartz. Thank you so much. And we'll be back in a few moments. And hello, you're back on Cafe of Delights with me, your host, Gail West. And I have today Richard Schwartz, who is the creator, inventor of the Internal Family Systems, IFS. He's been talking about the fact that we have a self which is whole and complete, and about these parts that actually navigate our lives in many ways. So we talked about protector parts, you call them little parts, what, exiles? Then firefighters. Can you give me some examples of what would be a firefighter?
Yeah, so if you think about, I'll point it at you, Gail. So if one of your exiles gets triggered, what's your first impulse, would you say?
I'm out of here.
Yeah, okay. So that's a common firefighter activity. It's very reactive, and it's not going to allow you to feel what the exiles got triggered by.
Yeah.
But let's say you can't leave. What's the next one on the hierarchy for you?
Just kind of going in and just being in this inner place where I don't talk to people and I become a hermit.
So shutting down, in a sense.
Yeah, shutting down. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a good one.
Yeah. So those are common. Other people immediately get enraged or, get taken away in their mind. They're just not there anymore. Or, if I get triggered, if my worthlessness gets triggered, I'll go write another article or something.
That's productive.
Yeah. But for a lot of people, it's the addictions, get you higher than the flames of emotion right now, immediately. Mm-hmm. So drugs or alcohol or work could be that. Or
I think a common to these days is Facebook.
Facebook, absolutely.
Social media.
Social media,
TikTok,
TV,
a TV. Yeah. So those
anything.
soft addictions.
Anything to distract you
Yeah.
from those raw emotions that are would otherwise overwhelm you and make it hard to function. So, yeah, those are just we all have our favorites. Those are some that come to mind now.
One of the things you mentioned before we took the break is the managers, and achievement is one of the managers. Right?
Can be, yeah.
So I'm curious when we think about that, as far as we talked about the kind of the collective systems, and particularly this culture right now that we're in, which American culture, we're in America, that seems to be one that is a driver that is part of the whole culture.
Yeah.
Doing, 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 doing. We have to do. And so many people say, well, I haven't been productive today. I'm not productive. And I would think that productivity would be an example of a manager.
Yeah, this part that again, it feels like if you're not productive, a couple of things that happen. One is if you ever sit still, those exiles will start to come up. And your worthlessness will start to come up. And so it's got to keep you dancing and busy. And the productivity has to counter the worthlessness. So I work with a lot of those kind of workaholic people, and that's often what's going on. And sitting still is terrifying.
Well, it's so I'd like to go more into the idea of self, and what are the aspects of self? And
Yeah, I mentioned earlier when I was experiencing people getting into self, I started to catalog the qualities that would emerge. And so we have what we call the eight C's of self or self-leadership, which include, just to mention them again, calm, curious, confident, compassion, courage, clarity, creativity and connectedness. And these are the qualities that I just saw that people would have in common when self was there. These are the qualities that applied the most to the healing endeavor. But also people would feel other things that I don't include, partly because they don't begin with the letter C, like joy or perspective or a number of other kinds of qualities, but those eight C's seem to be the most related to the healing endeavor. And that's held up actually quite well over all these years.
One of the ones that I know you have in the you have the what, five P's or six P's? Five P's
Five P's.
is playfulness. And what's
Yeah.
fascinating about that is the quality of the child
Yeah.
that brings that inner joy, that inner connection, that inner sense of the curiosity to the world. And when we think about that, it's like that is what gets smashed in so many people, the
Yeah,
inability to play.
that gets exiled, like we're
Right,
saying.
right, right.
Lock away those young, playful parts. For them, it's like insult to injury. The injury was the trauma or the shame they got from the parent or something like that. And then the insult is that you abandon them. You put them in places where they're isolated and they have no access to you. And then these managers take over and they're pretty joyless a lot of the time in their extreme roles. So, yeah, a lot of people forget how to play just because they're disconnected from those playful parts.
So you mentioned the idea of unburdening. Can you share what that is?
Yeah, so as I was getting to know these parts, they would talk about these extreme beliefs and emotions they carried, almost as if they weren't part of them, that it was something they had accumulated. And so it turns out, again, after all these years, that that's true, that parts are extreme, partly because they're frozen in time often during a trauma, but also during the trauma, they absorbed these extreme beliefs and emotions that drive the way they operate, almost like a virus, like the coronavirus. And so when they're willing to unload those beliefs and emotions, a process we call unburdening, they almost magically immediately transform into their naturally valuable states, almost like a curse has been lifted. So healing is often equated with this unburdening process. And also to do that, frequently we have to go, I might have you, Gail, see that little girl who's stuck in a bad place in your childhood. And I would say, Gail, I want you to be there with her in that time. And the process we call retrieval. And then when she's ready, bring her out of that place to the present with you or a fantasy place. And once she felt safe, we'd ask if she's ready to unload these extreme beliefs and emotions she got from that experience. And most parts, if they feel connected to you and trust they don't have to go back there, are willing to unburden, at which point they transform.
It's almost like magic.
Seems like it. Felt like it in the beginning. Yeah.
So you're an alchemist and a magician.
Some ways I believe that. And, you know, a lot of times the unburdening in the session isn't enough. You got to follow up and let them know that you still remember them and they don't have to go back. And so it is magical in many sessions, and then it won't last unless there's follow-up in many cases.
Well, I think some of it is that they don't want to be forgotten.
Exactly.
Like they had been in the past.
That's right,
and
exactly.
If you don't pay any attention to them, it's like, okay, what's the difference?
That's right. I might as well go back there.
Yeah.
What's familiar?
Who, you know, you claim you love me, you claim you want me, but you know, not really. Mm-hmm. So I think follow-up is really one of the things that is very important.
Totally.
People don't realize.
That's right. Yeah.
So I'm curious as to how IFS and internal family systems has evolved over the years. I know, and this is one of the things I really appreciate about you, Dick, is that so many people that create a model never evolve of themselves. And as I've known you, you have transformed and changed in so many ways. It's really lovely to watch. But the model has evolved also. It's not a static model. It's dynamic. Yeah. And that's what is so exciting about it.
Well, thanks for saying that, Gail. I think it's one of the things I feel proudest of, that I'm still willing to learn. And some of what's exciting to me right now is, again, in the last decade or so, our community has gotten to be extremely diverse. We have collaborations now with an organization called Black Therapists Rock and another called Clinicians of Color. And we're in the LGBT community. And so I just did a training with our up and coming leaders, a level 3 training, and over half were diverse in different forms and from all different countries. And I felt like I learned an enormous amount about the model, about what we can do differently, and how we can make it safer for that population, and how much they're taking it and adapting it to their cultures. So yeah, it's an ongoing, that's what keeps it interesting for me, is to see how it needs to change.
And evolve. And so how, from that experience, how do you feel it's evolved?
I think back in the day when you knew me,
I still know you.
Maybe I should ask you, What would you say would be the difference between when you first connected and now?
To me, there's such an amazing nuance that there hadn't been in the past. It was really powerful, but it was had a simplistic manner. But now there's so many nuances about how to work with parts, how to work with protectors, how to work and you have this collective of people that try to operate from self. That in and of itself creates a really powerful system. If we think about systems as dynamic, and internal family systems is a dynamic system, that it has been evolving dynamically with each person that learns how to use it.
I agree. And, if you were to, for me, to boil it down, I think I bring more self than I used to. I used to be very blended, I think, with certain kind of managers that would try to be much more controlling of the process, and that over time I've really learned to trust the self of the client and to give a lot of space. Like many of my sessions, people comment on how much silence there is, or how silent I am while the client's just describing what they're doing. And what I find over and over is my presence is really what opens the door, almost like a psychedelic, because the protectors feel their safety in my presence.
Right.
And that brings out the self of the client, who then starts to do the work. And mainly I find myself saying, now what do you want to say to that part? Now what do you want to do with this part? And just kind of following along a lot of the time. So I think it took me a long time to trust that self really does know how to heal, and to kind of get out of the way more and more.
Well, one of the questions I was going to ask you is how have you evolved in the model? But you just answered it.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of what I see. And
what's so powerful about that, Dick, is that you, and going back to so many people that I know from other, that have done other models and created other models, they don't grow with the model. Mm-hmm. You've continually grown with the model. You continue to emulate what you believe and what you teach. And that's so powerful.
Yeah, and I've been lucky because I've had people around me, yourself included, who busted my parts. When my parts were getting in the way, they'd let me know, sometimes in a very kind way and sometimes not so kind. But if I'm proud of anything, it's that I took that feedback seriously and then did my work. And the person you see now, as you know, is very different from the person you met in 1990.
Yeah.
Because of that, because people really sort of forced me to work on myself.
Well, as a testament to that is your book, the latest book that you wrote. This is the latest book. I don't know if people can see it. Is it blurred?
Yeah, it's a little blurred. I think if you move it forward.
Well, I'm going to stop my blurring my video so people can see. It's okay. No Bad Parts. To me, I have this thing about the each book in somebody's library has the energy of the person that wrote it. People don't realize that. You pick up a book and the energy of the person that wrote it is really low vibration. You pick that up. But this book has, I don't know if I can say, has such a high frequency that it is, and I was looking at it last night as I was preparing for this talk or interview. I could feel such love. Oh my God, I'm going to feel like crying, and such compassion that came from this book that you have for people and you have for your work and you have for the world, that it's really profound.
Yeah. very moved to hear you say that and say it with such emotion. Yeah, it was labor of love.
I'm actually crying. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. It was. It was a labor of love. It feels sort of channeled in some ways. And
yeah,
I'm very happy that it's out there.
Well, you've talked about guidance, and the thing that strikes me about this book, as opposed to so many other therapeutic models, it's incredibly spiritual.
Yeah.
This book talks a lot about self. When people sense how connected they are to humanity, they feel more curious about others and have more courage to help them. And the other thing that is, and here I'm going to quote from you. Can I do that? Self is a spiritual essence within us and around us, like a field that can quiet that thinking part of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to say about that? So you're talking about self is not a brain state. It is a spiritual essence.
Yeah, and that's part of the evolution as well, because when I first ran into it, I had trouble grounding it, and I was basically coming from a very scientific background, and I also had studied attachment theory, and attachment theory would say you shouldn't have any of those kinds of qualities unless you had a certain kind of good parenting during a critical period in your childhood. And I was working with clients who'd had horrible, horrible childhoods, and still they had all this. So I couldn't reconcile that. And it wasn't until people started saying, well, that sounds like Buddha nature, or that sounds like self in Hinduism, or that sounds like the soul in Christianity. And I started to explore that. And indeed, it turns out virtually every spiritual tradition has a word for it, even though almost no psychotherapies do.
Mm.
So for me, that is what it is. And it isn't isolated in our systems. It's a drop of the big ocean of God, or whatever you want to call that. And each of us carry that, but we're really connected when we access it to something much, much bigger. So yeah, the book is an attempt to lay out some of that.
Yeah, it's really powerful. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to explore more of this idea of self and how, as we connect more to it, we can actually transform the world. I'm curious about kind of working with the collective. So this is Cafe of Delights. I'm here with Dick Schwartz, the creator of Internal Family Systems, and we'll be right back. Thank you. Hello, I'm Gail West, your host at the Cafe of Delights, and we're back. I have Dr. Richard Schwartz, who created Internal Family Systems, IFS, here talking about parts, about self, and about many, many other things. We're so happy to have you. So I want to go more into the idea of, we've been talking about how IFS has really been transformative, both for many, many people, but you're starting to work with organizations. And one of the things you talk about is legacy burdens and the legacy burdens of the collective. Can we go a little bit more into that and how you'd see that as part of healing and systems as far as IFS and healing the world, basically?
Yeah.
That might be too much of a question.
Well, it's a big one. As you mentioned, or as I talked about earlier, the unburdening process is very transformative, and sending extreme beliefs and emotions out of your system. And in the early days, all the burdens I was learning about, when we would witness where parts were stuck in the past, were related to what we call personal burdens. They were personal traumas or attachment injuries are the scenes that the parts would show. And then some parts started showing scenes that were clearly from their ancestors' lives. And in exploring that, it turns out that there are things that might have happened a century ago that was some kind of big trauma in your family lineage, but then got transferred through the generations down to you. And you feel a lot of the, maybe the terror that somebody experienced during a war or a famine or something like that, that really has nothing to do with your life, but still has a big impact on your life. And so in exploring that, we tried to figure out how do we unload these legacy burdens as well as the personal burdens.
So you mentioned in the book something about the legacy burdens of, let's see, we talk about the legacy burdens of the collective. So racism, materialism, mm-hmm. individualism. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit?
As I, and part of this came from trying to write the book, it became clear to me that there are burdens that are from your direct family lineage or ancestors. And then there are burdens that came with your ethnic group. And then there are burdens that are just floating around our culture. I focused on the US mainly. And I tried to figure out which are the most toxic legacy burdens in the United States. And so I came up with four, but there are many others.
Mm-hmm.
And the four you just mentioned, although you missed one. So racism for sure, and then patriarchy.
Yeah.
And then individualism and materialism are all big drivers of many people in this culture, particularly white people.
So do you think it's one of the other things you talk about is protectors of countries and protectors of systems. And I've done a lot of work around money trauma, but you know, that's part of it is because I'm really, my passion is to heal trauma in the collective.
Mm-hmm.
When we think about that, how do we work with that? Is it possible to work with that as individuals? Can we act as proxies on behalf of these collective burdens together? Like, what do you think is the way that we can help to heal?
Yeah, I believe we can. When I did this training just this week, and there were some very powerful sessions where one in which a person saw an ancestor who was a slave and had a collar around his neck. And by the end, we had invited in all these ancestors who carried similar burdens and did a big unburdening of his whole lineage, really. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that there's some reality that happens in these other worlds that is cleaning things out. And so that's one way. And some of that, as you know, shamans do a lot of. And then I also believe there are ways to gather large groups of people together and to have everybody focus on the same burden or something similar and use all the self-energy in that collective to send out racism maybe together or to send out this toxic individualism that says the meritocracy that you're lazy if you don't succeed and things like that. And there's a guy named Thomas Hubel who's been doing that with large groups, and so I'm going to collaborate with him in a 5-session, I think, examination of some of what we're going to be talking about, how to do that with larger groups.
I'm remembering that I actually did something like that at one of the conferences. where we had one group of people uploading the trauma of the grandmothers, and another group of the grandfathers, another group of war and genocide, and another group of the other, of being the other. And it was really incredibly powerful because everybody, we did with image, everybody had similar images for each other. And so I think it is possible, because my thought was, can we act as proxies on behalf? And one of the things you're saying is that is entirely possible.
You know, I don't know for sure, but I believe so. That seems to be, you know, I'm still a scientist, so I need more data to
evidence
like that. I need evidence. But there's good indications that that's possible. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to go into a little bit more. You're talking about protectors. Too many interactions are protector wars. That's a quote from your book. Can you talk a little bit about that? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so most of us have a lot of vulnerable exiles. And when you have a bunch of those, then when you get into conflict with somebody, it isn't yourself that does the talking. It's these protectors that are used to protecting those exiles. And protectors are contagious. So if you and I are trying to work something out, and I get into my critic and I start to tell you what you did wrong from that energy, it's going to call for that part of you to respond. And so we'll just escalate. Those protectors just escalate. And the good news is self is also contagious. So if I can catch myself and ask that protector to give me the chance to lead this conversation, even if you're still in your protector, I can speak with a different tone of voice, a very different energy. I'll speak for the part that got angry or for the part that got hurt, if it feels safe enough. And not always, but often, your protector will relax back and we can have a self-led conversation. And that's a lot of what we try to do with couples, for example.
What about systems? So political systems, economic systems. One of the things you mention or kind of intimate that they have a self also, like countries.
Countries have a self. It's hard to find much of it in the United States right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I try to make the parallel that any system at any level that has a lot of exiles is going to have very extreme protectors and won't have a lot of access to stuff. And our country has huge numbers of exiles, partly because of the burdens of racism and patriarchy.
Individualism, and so on. Yeah, right.
Partly because of those, but also so many economic exiles. As Bernie Sanders keeps pointing out, 60% of our country lives paycheck to paycheck. And when there are so many people with that level of anxiety and struggle, there's going to be extreme protectors on both sides, and they're going to polarize with each other and obscure whatever self wants to come out. And then you also have all these moneyed vested interests that have control over a lot of it. So, and keep everybody exiled. So I'm still a structural family therapist in the sense that we can work with each person individually, but until some of that structure changes, it's going to be hard for a lot of, there'll still be a lot of suffering in this country. And so that's partly why I decided to start to aim toward influential people in the country. And so, like one example, in addition to the executive coaching programs we have, is I've gotten very interested in the impact of ketamine in IFS. And we're running ketamine and IFS retreats by invitation, and we're inviting leaders of various kinds to come so they can become more self-led, because there's so much healing that can happen very quickly. And then they can, like I said, self is contagious, so that they can bring more self to whatever systems they're involved in. So yeah, that's my vision now.
Well, that's a big vision, and it's exciting. And I think about the monetary system.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that it does have a self, because that's my thing. All these systems have a self. And if we can together shift our paradigm around generosity and collaboration, that feels like that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, just to mention, I got permission to say this. I've been working with a guy who is consulting to the World Bank and the IMF, and using IFS to depolarize the administration and the board, for example. So there's more self in those organizations. So that's the level that I'm trying to bring this.
That's exciting. So we have 2 minutes left. Do you have any last words of wisdom?
Only that it's great talking to you again, and I appreciate how much research you did for this, and what you said about the book, and yeah, it's just lovely to be with you. I wish you were still in the Chicago area, even though I'm sure you don't.
I miss my friends. And it's too bad that we moved right when you moved.
Yeah, it is too bad.
And any words of advice for people as far as how they can find out more about IFS, or how they can find an IFS therapist?
Our website is ifs-institute.com, and we have a directory of therapists on it. And there are a bunch of other books available through it or other places. And there's a lot of YouTube videos if people want to watch it in action. Yeah. We also have what we call the online circle training program. If therapists want to learn more about it, we have in-person trainings, but unfortunately, the waiting list is massive. I mean, unfortunately. So they're very hard to get into. But there is an online circle program where people can get oriented.
I'm so delighted and honored to be with you today. And I'm sure the people that are listening are just like wowed by your message and what you have to offer. Thank you so much. And this is Gail West, Cafe of Delights. Tune in next time, the second and fourth Thursday of the month at 10 a.m. Pacific. Thank you for tuning in to Cafe of Delights, conversations that enlighten and inspire with me, your host, Gail West. Listen or watch live every second and fourth Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com for a series of riveting interviews from those who are actively working at the edges of local, regional, and global transformation. From science to spirituality, culture, arts, and new economies, and more, we will explore how to create a world where all can thrive. For more information on hope for a new reality, visit me, Gail West, at successwithsoul.com.